Well, the time is now 1:06, and you're listening to Madison BookBeat here on WORT 89.9 FM, your local community radio station. I'm Bill Tischler, your host for today's Madison BookBeat show. Joining me in the studio is Judy Kurofsky, author of the new book, Disorderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice. Published in 2025 by New Village Press, the book exposes the hidden reality of America's elder care system through the story of her mother, who cycled through several assisted living facilities and hospice programs, each revealing gaps in oversight, staffing, and compassion. Part memoir, part investigative wake-up call, Disorderly Conduct shines a light on how profit-driven care models can fail the very people they're meant to protect. If you have an aging parent, a loved one, or if you work in healthcare, or simply care about how we treat our elders, you'll want to stay tuned for the next hour. Judy, thank you for joining us here in the studio on Madison BookBeat.
Thanks, Bill. I am so happy to be here. I'm so happy to have you help me expose the issues that we'll be discussing for the next hour.
Now, Judy, you've been in the Madison area for a very long time. Can you, for those who don't know your background, can you share a little bit about your background and maybe some of your early political experience here?
the one that people seem to identify me with, and we begin the story with, is that I was one of the first women mayors in the state of Wisconsin. At the time, I was the mayor of Middleton. I was indeed the only woman mayor in the state. But that's only a fact. But what was important is how and what I learned from the people who supported me and helped me gain political office. And at that time in Middleton, we were quite concerned about the care of the aging population. They actually did a survey of needs for the elderly, and many of the projects that we did focused on a facility for the senior citizens, programming for the senior citizens. And I'm so proud to say that that has become an ongoing program in Middleton. And in the time that I was the mayor, as it turned out, there were one or two issues, there are always issues, land use issues, about the development of facilities for elderly people. So I had an early start. That was many, many years ago.
And Judy, and after your time in mayor, as a mayor, you went back to school. Is that correct?
I did. I spent a little bit more time in state government. I did serve on the executive staff of one of the governors. I spent some time in the financial world. And I later was fortunate enough to return for what for me was a second master's degree in the University of Wisconsin Business School. And I had the good fortune to study in the real estate program under the revered Jim Graskamp.
And so how did all of that kind of early experience kind of lead you to taking an interest in the topic of assisted living?
I think what's important is, of course, a Graskamp maxim was people over profits. We learned about real estate development. We learned about land use. We learned about urban planning. But always from his perspective, it was the people came first. And quite fortunately for me, in about 2005, two of my real estate colleagues contacted me and asked if I would join them in a project that they were involved in already. They had already submitted a proposal for a study of institutional investing in senior housing. This was so cutting edge, Bill. This was so new. Senior housing was not then a category of real estate development. There were industrial developments. There were multifamily developments. There were hospitality developments, hotels going up around the world. But senior elder care, senior housing was not something that real estate investors, the institutional investors, saw as a category. So we broke it down and into the need the need was starting to become obvious almost 20 years ago, wasn't it? And we could perceive that things would change once the baby boomers came onto the scene, once that demographic need hit the need for senior housing. And now we are 20 years later, and it's really happened. The demographics has hit us. So thank you, Professor Graskamp, for making us aware of the people part of real estate and real estate development and investment in real estate. And the rest is what you and I are going to discuss for the next hour.
Yeah. So you mentioned demographics, and particularly the increased longevity of older adults beginning to drive demand for assisted living mm-hmm. and long-term care. Can you share
living,
some of the numbers?
Well, we're living longer. We're living more healthy lives, so we're living longer. Between 2010 and 2020, the two most recent census activities, the population of seniors over 65 in this country grew five times as fast as the overall population in that 10-year period. What has happened is that the baby boomers, those born between 1946 and 1964, have now become the elderly population, and they're driving the demand for senior care, elder care, senior housing, senior activities, investment in senior activities.
So I want to just kind of maybe jump back in time a little bit and kind of get to the beginning of assisted living. Mm-hmm. And you shared with me the origin story of Karen Brown Wilson. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I frequently, always refer to Karen Brown Wilson as my inspiration. Karen Brown Wilson's mother, actually, in the 1970s, at age 55, suffered a debilitating stroke. They lived in the state of Oregon, and her mother was placed in what we all knew. That's all we knew in terms of care for the elderly or those who had serious debilities, instabilities. They were placed in nursing homes. They were placed in wards where they were several patients on a floor, many patients on a floor. Meals came at the same time. Meds came at the same time. There really weren't any activities. I'm old enough so that I can remember one of those nursing homes in the neighborhood in which I grew up. And I would visit it because one of my friend's parents owned a nursing home. And I can't unsee the scene in the wards. Karen Brown Wilson's mother turned to her and said to her, "Get me out of here." So Karen Brown Wilson, who was a student in gerontology, and her husband, who fortuitously was a professor of gerontology, sat down at their kitchen table and came up with a different model for care for the elderly. And they named it assisted living. What they were focused on was a home, and home was the operative word, a home for people who did not need round-the-clock skilled nursing. They needed some help with some activities of daily living. They might have needed help with dressing or toileting or showering or meals, moving from a wheelchair to a dining room table. But they needed observation, but they did not need constant care. So Karen Brown Wilson and her husband began a facility. They named it assisted living. It was in Oregon. They called it Park Place. They had 121 residents. They had 100 employees. And then it worked so well. The model worked for them. They provided people with apartments, places that they could paint the walls if they wanted, but they could be observed and they could live their elder years without being in nursing home wards. Karen Brown Wilson opened another one and another one and another one. And Bill, by the time she was done, she owned 184 facilities in 18 states, and she had 3,000 employees. So what happened along the way was that they needed more funding, of course, and they brought investors in. remote decision making. I always picture a meeting table, sort of like the one that you and I are sitting at right now, where decisions were being made about the for the residents and about the residents. And Karen Brown Wilson became aware that the tasks of the business became more important than the residents. In time, Atul Gawande tells the story that I just told you. It's in his book, Being Mortal. In time, Karen Brown Wilson was quoted by Gawande as saying, "I love assisted living." She said it twice in his book. "I love assisted living, but I know that assisted living doesn't work because of the size of the business. It became difficult, too difficult, to provide the kind of care that she wanted to provide for the residents." She's really out of the business now. She serves, I believe, as a head of a nonprofit for frail elderly. She's doing good work, but she's no longer in the assisted living business.
Well, I mean, I guess that's surprising. I mean, that assisted living, we're only talking about 50 years ago that this really came about, and with this tremendous growth, how many assisted living facilities are there in America now?
There are 32,000. There are over a million people who are in assisted living facilities. And didn't we leave out the most important factor, Bill? Mm-hmm. As the facilities grew, there was never any oversight, no rules or regulation. There has never been any federal regulation over this growing, mushrooming business. When Karen Brown Wilson left the biz, they were in 18 states. Now they're all over the country, many in Wisconsin, of course. No federal rules, no federal definition. This became quite obvious during the pandemic. We do not even know how many people died in assisted living facilities during the pandemic because there were no federal regs. There was nobody to report to. In time, the assisted living facilities, by May of 2020, they started to volunteer information. So we have some idea. The states do have licensing rules, some regulations. Our state has an administrative code that relates to safety, food, activities, licensing, even evictions from assisted living facilities, but it's not stringent, and it's not kept up. Even our state code doesn't reflect the current needs of assisted living facilities or the residents.
But this contrasts with the regulations that we have for nursing homes in the states.
Especially. Yes, and there's the rub. There are nursing homes still, the kind of facility that Karen Brown Wilson's mom wanted to be sprung from. We still have those skilled nursing facilities. They're quite important, of course, for people who have immediate needs after surgery or accidents and or towards the end of their lives when they need round-the-clock care. Those nursing homes that still exist are regulated by the federal government. Assisted living is not. And the pay system is different. When people are in nursing homes, for the most part, the cost will be paid for by Medicare if it's a short-term stay after surgery. But for the long-term care, it's paid for by Medicaid. But assisted living, the type facility that provides help with some daily activities, some observations, some activities, pretty facilities, actually. They look pretty attractive when you walk in the door. They are predominantly private pay. People are paying for those rooms, that care, that attention, or lack of attention at certain points, with their own pensions, savings, investments, 401ks, private pay.
And also the staffing too. I mean, for a nursing home, you have to have a degree.
Bingo! License. Right, nursing homes. They do have skilled nursing RNs, LPNs on staff, and some, a lot, of CNA, certified nursing assistants, in an assisted living facility, all of the attention, all of it, all of those transfers I talked about, the meals, the help in the showers, the help with moving from a wheelchair to a table, it's all, for the most part, performed by CNA, certified nursing assistants. There are some assisted living facilities, some in this county, that do not have a nurse on board at all. My mother was in two of those. You mentioned that we moved, or you sort of alluded to the fact that my mom was moved between facilities. One of the final straws that allowed me to make the decision to move my mom from her first assisted living facility to the second was the fact that the nurse was fired. And the director said to me, I can run this place without a nurse. As a matter of fact, the Wisconsin code, the administrative code that covers all of the issues about assisted living, limits the number of hours of nursing care in an assisted living facility to 3 hours a week per resident. So they're not intended to be health facilities. They're not intended to be places where nurses are present. But as I said, I moved my mom out of one because I thought a nurse should at least be around, on board, visible. So there's the difference, a skilled nursing facility versus assisted living.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to talking about your mother, but at first I want to just mention to our listeners the time is now 1:23, and you're listening to Madison BookBeat here on WORT 89.9, your local listener-sponsored radio station. I'm Bill Tischler, your host for today's show, and joining me in the studio is Judy Kurowski, the author of the new book, Dis-Elderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice, which was published in 2025 by New Village Press. And this book exposes the hidden realities of America's elder care system through the story of her mother, who cycled through several assisted living facilities and hospice programs, each revealing gaps in oversight, staffing, and compassion. Now, Judy, I want to kind of turn now to talking about your mother and look, you know, reading through your book on page 128, there is a lovely photograph of your mother. And I was wondering if you could just tell the radio listeners a little bit about her.
My mother, Lillian Deutsch, grew up in Boston. She was the eldest of three children whose mom died of a self-induced abortion when my mother was 11 years old, leaving her, the three children, my mom being the eldest, was in charge, and my grandfather. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts would not allow a single parent to rear, or at least a single dad, to rear three kids. And the three of them were split into foster homes. As my uncle, her younger brother, said to me not that long ago, you know, they always wanted to have the girls as foster because they could do the housework. In time, my mother, through the shrewdness that she had her whole life, the cleverness, appealed to her dad, who appealed to this Commonwealth, and they were allowed to, through high school, live in one place, one house. Fast forward to when I was in college, my mom, who had in the intervening years been a housewife, helped my father in his store. He had a fairly popular hardware store. And she'd had various part-time jobs because I was in school and in high school. But once I went to college, she walked into the lobby of what was then a skyscraper in Boston, New England Tell and Tell, and said to the receptionist, I want to have a job interview today. You need to hire me. And Bill, they did. And my mom had a career many decades, as an advertising person for what was then called Yellow Pages. She wrote the ads, laid out the ads, called the national corporations, because that's how Yellow Pages worked, in the New England phone book, the Boston phone book. There were ads for national corporations. And my mother moved up and moved up and moved up the ranks of management until her retirement, when they said to me, I went to her party, of course, and they said to me, do you understand how rare this is for a woman, a Jewish woman, to rise to this level in a corporation that was basically AT&T? After she, I realized it after that, of course. After my parents retired to Florida and my dad died, my mom started an active social life. One of her long-term partners was a magician, a practicing magician. So she did some traveling around the country. And they even came to Wisconsin so they could go to the Houdini Museum, because that magician was the last surviving magician who had seen Houdini perform. There was always wonderful things going on. But my mom was an entertainer in her own right. She, in her retirement, developed a program of stand-up comedy. She performed when she was still in Florida. And once she moved to Madison, she performed. She performed at what was then a piano bar, a smaller piano bar on State Street. She would go on Thursday nights at intermission. The people at the piano bar, the two soloists, would say they had a special guest. My mom would sit up on the bar stool and say, quiet down, everyone. And everyone did quiet down. And she told her jokes. So she had a fairly active, fairly happy, fairly productive 7 or 8 years in this community. And I was her buddy. I had the opportunity to travel with her, travel beyond the state. She came to some business meetings with me. But then my mom suffered a stroke, and she was assigned, really, to assisted living. They came to me in the hospital. I was unprepared for this. Many people have been through this experience. They came to me and said that she could not go back to independent living, as if I couldn't figure that out myself, and actually I couldn't. And from that time on, my mom was in assisted living for 4.5 years. And as you have already said, she did not stay in the assisted living to which she moved initially. She moved on, she moved on, she moved on. She never had, she didn't have Alzheimer's. She did have what they term vascular dementia. She was confused and difficult to work with sometimes, a lot. But she always knew who we were. She knew who I was. She knew who my dog was. She knew who my kids were. And that was a blessing to me, that she stayed alert until her last breath, really.
Now, in the early part of our show, you talked about, you know, the early, you know, work and research you did in assisted living. But, you know, when we were talking before the show started, you know, once your mother entered assisted living, you know, there are some surprises, or you knew very little. Could you maybe talk about, you know, like, you know, what you kind of what you learned from once your mother started to need additional assistance?
What I learned was that I didn't know anything. I was one of three people who did a white paper about investing in senior living, and I honestly didn't know about the day-to-day mechanics of the industry. And it is an industry. It is a business. I didn't know how important this continuation of staffing was, because staffing came and went. Unfortunately, that'll probably continue because we're in a major staffing crisis in every industry, but it falls most noticeably on the healthcare industry. People don't stay. They should, but they don't. I found out that so many of the promises that were made about life in assisted living really didn't happen. That there were promises about meals. There were promises about activities. There were even schedules posted in, I think, every facility that she was in, of what the daily, weekly, monthly activities would be, but they didn't happen. There were problems with meds, always problems with meds, because the CNAs, there were registered nurses, LPNs, licensed nurses, and then CNAs. There are people certified in this state to pass out medications in assisted living facilities who aren't even certified nursing assistants. They don't even have that designation. It's a lesser designation to be able to pass out meds. What could be more important than passing out medications? And yet it falls to the least highly licensed, least highly trained people on the staff. I found out so many things, Bill. One thread was the realization that my mother was in a facility somewhere in Dane County, she was in several, but decisions were being made a state and a half away. In one facility, she continued to fall out of bed because she wanted to use the bathroom at night, and she thought that she could, but by then she really couldn't. But she tried to get out of bed and end up on the floor. I would receive a call from Edina, Minnesota. My mother was in a facility in Dane County, and I got to know that person by first name. So the remote decision making, the questions about management are not obvious. We're not obvious to me, and really not obvious to people who are making a quick decision about where their loved ones will be. And quite often, it's where will they be tomorrow, because they're at the end of their hospital stay and they need to be moved from the hospital to another facility. When people are moving into independent living, which is sort of a leader into assisted living in many cases, they take time. They look around. They see different facilities. People who are in the city, there's a wealth of independent living options and time to do it and time to make a deposit and time to be on a waiting list and time to close down the house or apartment that they're currently living in. Assisted living decisions are made under duress. They're made quickly, and that's part of the equation. That's what the investors depend on, because they are profiteering. They're profiteering, making money from people who are making emotional decisions and don't have the time to research, analyze the best option.
So Judy, for those listeners, with parents and loved ones who are, living independently, but again, looking ahead, what advice would you give to somebody, knowing eventually they're going to be put in the situation that you were in?
Yeah, I mean, the advice would be not to ask me that question, because everybody does. I think read the book. I mean, I think people need to have their eyes opened to what the reality of the business, of the industry is. I think people need to know that it's not unlikely or even unsightly to move from facility to facility. Some people move parents or loved ones or spouses to a different facilities because of the size, the scale. They know that they'll get better attention, have attention that is more to their needs in a smaller facility. Some want to move to a larger one. To be aware that the decisions probably aren't permanent, except, of course, towards the end of life. I would talk to people. Mm-hmm. Talking helped me so frequently. I would be in a restaurant, in a bar. It was during COVID. People would say, "What are you doing now, Judy?" And I'd say, "I'm writing. I seem to be collating all of these anecdotes about my mom, and they seem to be coming together to be a book. What's the book about?" And as soon as I would say what the book was about, other people would have comments. They would want to talk about it. Bill, yesterday's New York Times center section in the opinion section, a huge long article. Many of the listeners may have seen it. The comedy and horror of becoming my parents' keepers. This is about two sisters, one of whom is apparently on the staff of the New York Times. That's why she gets so much ink, I suspect. But they do talk about the pressures, the pain, the emotions that family members go through. And they say at one point that everybody wants to talk about this. Everybody wants to share their stories. And that's a really good thing, because we no longer feel that we're alone. What a terrible feeling to have when the pressure is on to be taking care of a aging loved one. But we hear about other options. People do take other options. I don't know how to answer that question any better. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Just in the short time that I've been talking to colleagues at work and friends that I'd be interviewing you on BookBeat, people have shared stories with me, and what I realize is, you know, there are a lot of us out there in a situation where we are going to be faced with where we're going to place our parents, our loved ones, you know.
So let us share. If anything does happen in Congress, there is a bill right now supported by some pretty well-known senators to reinstitute the call for a committee on assisted living, which they've been talking about this since 2013 and probably even before that. The difference about this bill is that the makeup of the committee that would be discussing problems in assisted living, financing of assisted living, safety in assisted living, would include residents of the facilities. And actually, somebody sent me an article from, I believe, Denmark, where they have a much larger, you would love these, Bill, since you're an alder, much larger citizen participation activities. But in those, they actually have addressed these questions, and they have decided to include family of residents on the committees that are discussing assisted living.
And before we kind of dive into more politics and what we can do looking forward, I know there's a passage from your book that you wanted to read, and I was wondering if you could just take some time and read that for us.
Sure. This kind of ties things up, and it's spoiler alert, I guess. I think we're focused here in our discussion, and that's good, on assisted living. We haven't addressed the hospice component, you and I. My mom did go on hospice and was on hospice for almost 3 years until she died. I think 3.5 years, over 3 years, I'm sorry. But what was important to me is that I was working with her every single day. And there actually was a trifecta. The trifecta was made up of the hospital, which included her personal physician and those clinics that she did visit regularly. The assisted living, which, as I said, for the most part, was care by CNAs, but in a lot of them, there was a nurse, at least on staff. And then hospice, once my mom became a patient of hospice and received hospice services and hospice attention and hospice visits. So I wrote this. For us, the dangerous flaw in the hospital, assisted living, hospice trifecta was the medicine order and distribution web. On the night my mom died, I realized I should have been more wary of the intricate communications trap that could collapse around us, leaving her without morphine, the common end-of-life prescription that would have assisted us through a merciful passage. As I said, it's a spoiler alert because the end of my mom's life was not pretty. It was not what people now call a good death. What was important, however, is to realize that she was part of this advanced system in an advanced economy, in a progressive community. She had access to both hospital, assisted living, and hospice care. And the promise of that trifecta, the promise of that care, did not work out. And Bill, before we go any farther or take a break, which I think you might be getting ready to do, I do need to address this. Mm-hmm. I am totally aware, completely aware, that there are families and patients and loved ones who do receive exactly the care that they sign up for. And the experience is one of compassion and continuous care until the end. And I acknowledge that, and I'm grateful for that, and I'm happy every time somebody looks at me and says that to me. But as the article in the New York Times yesterday said, the stories pour out once people start talking about situations that don't work. The stories just pour out.
Yeah. Well, we are going to take a short station break here. The time is now 1:41. You're listening to Madison BookBeat here on WORT 89.9, your local listener sponsor radio station. I'm Bill Tischler. And you're listening to, just a second here.
Are we offline?
No, we're still on.
Oh, we're still
on.
Okay, hello.
We're still on the air. I'm here with Judy Kurofsky here in the studio at WORT, and she is the author of the new book, Disorderly Conduct, The Flawed Business of Assisted Living and Hospice, published in 2025 by New Village Press. Part memoir, part investigative wake-up call, Disorderly Conduct shines a light on how profit-driven care models can fail the very people they're meant to protect. The book also urges families, policymakers, and future caregivers to rethink how we support older adults with dignity and respect. Now, Judy, we talked a little bit about hospice care, and I wanted to, I'm glad we had a chance to kind of go through that passage, very difficult. And my condolences on the death of your mother, right? But I want to kind of talk about kind of where, what we can do looking forward, especially you mentioned policymakers and lawmakers, and as a former elected official, and somebody who's researched this and now has lived through this personally, what advice would you give to both local, state, and federal policymakers who want really to improve assisted living in our country?
All of those? I'm teasing you. And again, I'm sorry, I thought there was a break here. You can tell I've been on so many podcasts where there's a break for some commercial for something, but we're not advertising anything.
That's one of the benefits of not we don't have to worry about commercials.
We're just advertising your wonderful interview, so thank you. Let's talk a little bit about hospice and what I learned about hospice, which I didn't know. Many people don't know. Hospice itself is a business, Bill. Hospice provides care, provides services, provides equipment like wheelchairs and incontinence supplies, and a certain, they help to procure some medicines. Every single thing that hospice provides is reimbursed through Medicare. Hospice facilities agencies are quite conscious that at any given time, any one of them could be audited for not following the Medicare rules. And frequently when I've spoken in various places, it surprises me, it warms my heart, that hospice, former hospice people, present hospice providers, nurses for the most part, come to my discussion because they want to express how it was for them to be working in a system where actually the facility, the agency, was paid on a per diem basis for every day of hospice care. And again, I think I started to say this, no hospice agency wants to be audited, so they're quite careful to follow the Medicare rules. Here's the big one, Bill. Medicare requires hospice agencies to serve only people whom have been certified, that's in quotes because I don't know how you do that, certified to be 6 months away from death. How do you do that? How would you do that with my mother, who is not dying of cancer or heart disease or a kidney failure or one of the things that they can, unfortunately, there is a sort of timetable. My mother was dying because she was growing old. When she was 99 and a half, in September of 2017, the hospice agency discontinued services. I have a 99 and a half year old mom. We're in a assisted living facility that came to me and said, she can no longer stay here without hospice. I said, that was not part of the contract. Wait, I'm dealing with needing to find wheelchair and supplies and bandages for her, and now we have to move. And Bill, we did have to move because they did have the right, of course, was in the contract in the small print that I probably glossed over, that that we could move. And even had they at that point allowed us to stay, quite honestly, I didn't want my mom in that facility. So we did move at 99 and a half. And for the rest, almost all of the rest of her life, which is about another 6 months, I did all of that. I found a wheelchair on Amazon. I had it delivered to her, to the facility. I assembled it. I was very good at assembling wheelchairs at that point. I stopped at a drugstore every night, an all-night drugstore, to get her cough medicine or whatever her need of the day was, because nothing was being provided by hospice at that time. That quirk hits a certain percentage of hospice recipients every year, and my mother was unfortunate enough to be one of those people. That is being addressed. I mean, there are academics who are looking at that, and that could perhaps get changed. I'm not the only person in America to be saying that this can't continue, this six-month rule. As far as the other questions beyond the hospice six-month rule, if anybody who is listening takes anything from this interview, and I hope they take a lot of things, that one, that hospice itself is a business, is quite important, because I think for all kinds of reasons, we good reasons, we see hospice as a philanthropy, a charity, because they do solicit funds from the community, and they should, because of the work that they do. It's also important to understand that there's not just one hospice in any community. There are actually several. This community has a nonprofit hospice and a for-profit hospice, which I became aware of because some of them started to solicit me to sign my mother up. So it's their businesses. You wanted me to discuss...
Yeah, I guess.
What would I say to local, state, and federal officials?
Yeah, I'm thinking. Okay. I'm thinking more at maybe getting down to the state level. What can the state do, and then also what can we do here?
Here, Bill, and look across the table at you, I think of one area that I don't discuss much, or haven't publicly or in any podcast that I've done. Let's talk about local decision makers, to whom proposals come all the time. They did to me when I was both on the city council, which I was, and then mayor of Middleton, to develop property for senior housing. Senior housing seems to have a gold star on it. Let's do it. We need this. I say, let's look at the management team. Let's look at the purpose. Let's look at whether this is a for-profit or non-profit entity. As soon as it's the non-profit entity, there go the property taxes to the community, and we should be aware of it, especially as local officials. But that's really, really difficult to say, isn't it? So let's start with land use planning, because as I look at great swaths of land being developed in Middleton, beyond Middleton, one of the first things that goes in now is a huge assisted living, a long-term care facility, not necessarily just assisted living. So local officials, start to ask questions, and I'd be glad to talk to you. In our state, there we do have an administrative code that covers continuing care retirement facilities, which includes assisted living, which is what we've focused on today. None of the chapters in the code address the funding, the management. And I think that's a very important question that our state officials could start addressing. Who actually is managing these facilities? As you know, as I know, there's ownership and management. And the management sometimes is part of a huge organization, bigger than the facility itself. And they're often in small print at the bottom of the website or the contract. We're not made aware of who is doing the day-to-day management. So what about the funding? Also, this is quite new, Bill, but it's referred to in the article that was in the opinion piece in the New York Times yesterday. It's being referred to all the time. AI, our new friend. So much is able to be done in assisted living facilities, in nursing homes, in long-term care facilities, from bringing meds to bringing diet to keeping track of people to finding out where they are. The reverse of the fob that my mom used to wear that she pushed to tell somebody that she needed help. But with AI and an AI monitor, that the staff could know at any given time where all the people are. The Find My option, which I use to find my friends sometimes on my iPhone. What are we doing with all of the data that's being generated and will continue to be generated by AI? Let's watch that. There's something that our state representatives could start asking questions about. And one of them is safety. As I look at our administrative code, I think we've covered most of the safety issues. It has come up in other states. It came up in Massachusetts this summer where a fire in an assisted living facility caused the death of 10 residents. And a lot of questions are being asked about how that could possibly have happened. So we would want to make absolutely sure, and I've been assured by our own members of our own fire department, actually, that type tragedy would not happen here.
You're talking about a facility out on the East Coast?
On the East Coast. This was in Fall River, Massachusetts. On July 13th, a fire erupted. And before the night was over, 10 people had died, or several died. And by the time the story was, some did go to the hospital, but ultimately 10 people died. They died because the fire people could not even pull them out through the front door. The facility was a renovated multifamily residence. Yeah. So the door wasn't wide enough to push a gurney wheelchair fire person through. And there were window air conditioners that were blocking egress from the first floor rooms. So those kinds of questions have to be looked at and addressed. Safety, funding, AI. Mm. And our state policymakers could do that. And they should do that because of what we said in the beginning of this interview. Mm-hmm. The demographics, the numbers, the elderly population, everybody campaigns to the youth, and they should. The youth are going to take over our country and our care. But the numbers of people who are moving into the senior ranks are making some people extremely wealthy because they're providing services for a market that's expanding, and they do not have to do anything to generate that market.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, you know, with the need for housing, especially here here in Madison, if we have senior living and assisted living that where people feel is safe, is regulated, people might be more willing to move, out of their house. I mean, I'm thinking of single family house where they may have, raised a family. So this does have some very big implications.
It's a maxim, isn't it? We're talking about the middle market. We're talking about people, again, who have fortunately or unfortunately, in terms of where the money ultimately goes, they have the ability to pay for the care for a certain number of years. They've calculated that. Their children have calculated that. And yes, it would be much easier on a lot of people if they moved to a facility. And I'm not the person to talk about that, too, since I'm still in my own residence. But again, this article, which is repeating what a lot of articles and comments and commentators say, the article that was in that opinion piece from yesterday's newspaper, that was about basically about two sisters who were taking care of their parents at home.
Well, we just have about 5 minutes left on the show, and I want people to kind of, we've talked about a lot of topics, and I'm sure people will want to learn more, but you have an op-ed piece coming out here in Madison, right?
I do, and thank you for mentioning that. This will be in Isthmus, and the Isthmus staff and editors have been very kind with me. We never said, by the way, Bill, that I'm not an author. This is my first book, my first experience doing a lot of this, not public speaking, as you might have gathered, but for sure writing and editing and then doing op-eds. I had one op-ed in U.S. News and World Report, and there's another one coming out in an online journal in December. But what's coming out this week on Thursday in Isthmus is an article about what we call the gray tsunami, which is the baby boomers,
right,
who have aged, the baby boomers who, until it seems very recently, were making decisions for their own parents. I'm 2 years older than any baby boomer. But you can kind of group me in that age group. I was making decisions for my mom. Now the baby boomers themselves have become the elderly. And for anybody who has followed population trends or demographics or that famous watermelon going through the python, the baby boomer years were just year after year after year of increased births and effects on all kinds of parts, segments of the economy, and now it's affecting elder care.
Yeah, well, I'll be looking to read the Isthmus. And I also want to encourage people to go out and to take a closer look at your book, because there's a lot in it that we haven't had a chance to cover.
So we can do three things. We can access the website for my book, which is www.diselderlyconduct.com. And that has a lot of information on it, places that I've appeared, op-eds that I've written, comments about the book, reviews of the book. I've had three really above average reviews that I've been quite happy with. It also talks about my appearances, and one of those, Bill, is going to be in your district, thanks to you. I will be appearing at the District 11 Book Talk, Book Club, on December 10th at the Sequoia Library at 7 p.m. And there will be books available there for purchase. People can also purchase them online at the major places where people buy books online. That's all on my website. Lake City Books, where I have my book launch, always has books, and I've signed some there. And I believe that Mystery to Me has copies of the book now.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing up my worlds sometimes overlap with with books and politics and issues like that. But thank you for bringing that up. And yeah, people are more than welcome to come and see you and hear you in person rather than just here on the radio. We're just about up on time. And I guess, is there any kind of closing thought? You have about 15 seconds to give us a closing thought.
I think I said it a few times. Use that quote that was in the New York Times yesterday, stories just pour out. What's most important for people to hear is that for a long time I was doing this by myself. It was Judy and her mother, Judy and her cute mother, who said funny things, and I kept track of the stories. Then they weren't so funny, but I continued to keep track of them. At some point, I came to understand that people wanted to be in these discussions with me. It was therapeutic for them. Everybody has this story. When Governor Tim Walz appeared in Madison this fall for Idea Fest, I had an opportunity to greet him the night before, or an hour before. And he said to me, "We are dealing with this with my mother-in-law." Bill, it's everybody's story. It's blue state, it's red state. Every person is, it's bipartisan. We all need to work on it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judy. And I guess, we're out of time, and I want to thank our guest, Judy Krofsky, for joining us here on Madison BookBeat. I also want to thank the people who make this show possible, our sound engineer, Jeff Calhoun, our producer, Sarah Gaber, And also our news director, Nate Carlin. Coming up next, and I'm kind of chewing into a little bit of his time, is we have All Around Jazz with Alex Wilding White. I'm Bill Tischler, and I want to thank you for listening to Madison BookBeat and asking all of you to keep reading, keep thinking, and most important, keep voting. So thank you.